This episode is brought to you by the Election Network. It's the first part of our three-part series exploring democracy and human rights from the lens of women in Nigeria.
Nigeria is Africa's most populous democracy, but has among the lowest number of women in office in the world.
Starting this episode with unpleasant stats wasn't part of my initial plan. However, if we're to engage in an honest discussion about the landscape of Nigerian women in politics and governance, it's important to acknowledge the not-so-great data.
2023 elections have now been concluded, but one of the issues brought to the fore is the gap in the representation of women in elective positions.
Since 2011, women's representation in Nigerian politics has trended downwards, and the 2023 election cycle confirmed the expectations of poor outcomes for female candidates at the polls. For context, women have less than 10% representation in the country's National Assembly. And historically, Nigeria has never had a woman president, vice president, or governor elected in any of its 36 states. So, yes, that's over six decades without a woman holding any of the country's top elective positions in any capacity.
Hello, Aisha. My name is Sewe Sibem. I'm an entrepreneur, a scientist, a humanitarian, a coach, and a politician. I live in Makurdi, Nigeria.
Sewusi wears many hats, but in this episode, we focus on her role as a politician. Through her story and personal experiences, we explore the realities of running for office as a woman in Nigeria, discussing the good, the bad, and the ugly. Additionally, we jump into the history of women in politics and governance before independence and consult with expert Sholakwe Shonuga to unpack what the current landscape looks like. Hi, my name is Aisha Salahuddin, and I like girls. This is a narrative storytelling podcast about African women and the different experiences life throws at us for being women. In 2019, at the age of 29, Sewusi Bem ran for a seat in the Benue State House of Assembly. The year before, in 2018, she was inspired to run for office by a dream, literally.
I did have a dream. I was sleeping and I had this dream that, Sewusi, you need to do something. And I woke up. I remember I had a dream, but I did not remember the exact contents of this dream.
So Sewusi is a practicing Christian, right? So during morning devotion that day with her mom and siblings, her dream became somewhat clearer, and she interpreted it as a divine call to pursue the legislative seat representing Boko East constituency in Benue State, North Central Nigeria. If elected, she would join the Benue State lawmakers tasked with creating, amending, and repealing laws alongside her peers. But first, she sought her immediate family's blessing during that morning's prayers.
So mom was like, wow, this is a tough one. Then my younger brother, my immediate younger brother was like, no, mom, we need to support her. If she said she has a dream and it's a calling, then let her give a shot. There's nothing wrong with that. Then I said, thank you very much for your support. And I asked mom, how do you feel about it? They said, okay, let us pray. So we prayed about it. And I said, okay, let me do this.
Sewusi believes contesting for office is God's calling, right? But even as a child growing up in Makurdi, Benue State, she exhibited signs that one could argue indicated a political inclination long before that dream ever occurred.
So let's talk a little bit about growing up, right? What kind of child were you? I know that you were extroverted, you shared your opinions often. Tell me a little bit more about that and what growing up was like.
It's super Thank you summary. Very much. Growing up was very interesting for me. I was not a laid-back child at all. I was very outspoken. I was a bit boisterous.
Sewuse Bem is the third of five children. She grew up in Makurdi, Benue State, North Central Nigeria, with her parents and siblings, three brothers and a sister. Growing up, she was the child who loved asking questions and challenging adults. In fact, she was so assertive that she sometimes mediated requests on behalf of her four siblings with her parents.
And growing up, my father was somebody that was very, very influential on the children. He made us to understand that there was no difference between the male child and the female child. We were all human, and roles were just what society has assigned. A boy or a female can do what the other gender can do.
For the most part, at home, Sewuse and her siblings did everything together. There were hardly any conversations about her and her sister adhering to traditional roles like cooking or cleaning. In fact, according to her, her dad did the cooking and ensured everyone shared such roles. And at first, she attended an all-girls secondary school where the girls had to do everything for themselves. As a result, there were hardly any discussions about specific roles or activities for girls. There was nobody to discriminate against because, well, they were all girls. She simply assumed that was how the world functioned. But at the age of 14, she transitioned to a mixed secondary school for her senior year. And that's when she clocked that the world isn't exactly fair to women.
So what happened was, I was in school being the normal me, proactive, running around, climbing desk, trees, shouting, I'm doing anything I feel like I should do. Then my male classmates were like, "Sewuse, can you remember that you are a girl? A girl shouldn't do this. A girl should do be heard. A girl should be seen." I was like, "Oh yeah, where's that coming from? I have to do everything I want. I am human. I should be seen. I should be heard. I should be felt."
This switch was Sewuse's first real encounter with traditional gender roles. She recognized how the world differed for women like her and became aware of the immediate prejudices women face in daily life. Interestingly, this realization turned her into something of a women's rights activist. She became known as the determined girl who insisted on doing anything the boys could do as well.
So you became kind of like a mini activist in school?
Absolutely, I was. Exactly, I was a mini activist starting in secondary school.
And as Sewuse grew older, she consistently spoke up for women and young girls, calling out injustices immediately. This passion for advocacy, alongside contesting for a school election, made her a bit famous at the Federal University of Agriculture, Makurdi, where she pursued a degree in microbiology.
Which was 2010, came the SU elections. And then I became very interested because, not just because I wanted to be heard and seen, but because I wanted to participate in the welfare of the students and as well participate in creating a consciousness in my fellow students.
Sewuse was not successful with her bid to become vice president of the student union in uni, but she put up a good fight, and it gave her a small glimpse into the bigger, much more complicated world of politics, one that she dove into a few years later. After the break, Sewuse contests for a seat in the 2019 State House of Assembly elections and is immediately confronted with a ton of challenges solely because of her gender. After that dream in 2018, when Sewuse was sure she'd contest in the 2019 elections, she double-checked the requirements for a seat in the Benue State House of Assembly. Nigerian citizenship? Check. Age 25 and above? Check. Member of a political party? Check. No criminal record? Check. Education up to school certificate level? Double check. To be clear, before Sewuse decided to run for office, she was already a member of one of Nigeria's many smaller political parties. In fact, she volunteered to go around her neighborhood to talk to people on behalf of the party about the importance of political awareness and participation. But when she decided to contest for a seat in the State House of Assembly, she had to think more critically about which party to represent.
So Anna said, okay, I cannot get a ticket in the big political parties. So let me go to a smaller political party. And the tickets, the amount of money tickets are sold for in bigger political parties are much more compared to smaller political parties. And the smaller political parties, because they want more people, they don't hide the publicity that firms are almost free for women.
Sewuse ran under the banner of the People's Redemption Party, PRP, a smaller, less-known political party in Nigeria. As she mentioned, obtaining a nomination form from Nigeria's two biggest political parties can be quite expensive. For context, in 2019, Nigeria's ruling party, the APC, priced its nomination form for the State House of Assembly position at 750,000 naira and the Express of Interest form at 100,000 naira, which comes to a total of about $2,777 using the official exchange rate at the time. The opposition party, PDP, set its nomination form for the same seat at 500,000 naira and its expression of interest form for 100,000 naira, roughly $1,960 at the time. These numbers are incredibly high for the average Nigerian. So it's understandable that Sewuse chose PRP, which offered a more affordable nomination form. She also preferred to avoid the intense fight for space that is common within the larger political parties.
When I picked up my form to run for office, there were certainly pushbacks against me. There were pushbacks because of my gender and some because of my age in 2019. They were like, what would a young woman want to run for office? Why shouldn't she just go get married? Some even said it into my face that, why aren't you trying to look at a family or something?
In October 2018, Sewuse won her party's primary elections and she immediately began campaigning ahead of the March 2019 general elections. Remember, at the time, she was 29. So many people she encountered believed her place was at home with a family, not on the streets canvassing for votes to be elected into the State House of Assembly.
People that make such remarks were random people I was campaigning to. Because when you go to talk to them, they have already had their opinion on whom they want to vote or what they want to vote. So when I went to campaign to them, they were opposed to my candidacy because I am a woman and a young one at that matter. In Benue State, an older and married woman have a better chance of winning elections compared to a young woman. They feel you have grown up, you have gone to school, the next thing should be for you to get married and make babies. And when you want to pick up a career, then problem starts.
It's funny, but I understand exactly what Sewuse means. In many parts of Nigeria, there's an assumption that women who are married and have children are more mature and presumably better equipped to manage affairs based on the assumption that they can run a home. This bias extends to politics, affecting candidates like Sewuse, who are younger and unmarried. It's a prejudice mindset that complicates the electoral journey for women like her. Sewuse's campaign lasted about 6 weeks until elections. Throughout this period, she had to deal with misogyny and discouraging comments from people who felt the position would be better suited for a man. As you know, Sewuse participated in an election at university, so to an extent, she knew she'd face discrimination for being a woman in this election. She says she found all the people questioning her gender quite distracting during the campaign. You know, all the side talk hit her hard, but she quickly found ways to brush it off and focus on convincing the people of Boko East to vote for her. Convincing Cultural and traditional barriers are huge blockers for women in politics and governance in Nigeria. Like with Sewu saying, if you decide to run for office, even if you're qualified, people will likely question you for your gender and assume you don't deserve to be there. So I invited an expert to break down how society, instead of questioning competence, tends to focus on gender in politics.
So my name is Sholakwe Shonoga. I live in Abuja, Nigeria, and I am a development professional, you know, in summary.
Sholakwe is the policy and strategic partnerships manager at Electa. Electa is a not-for-profit organization in Nigeria that is focused on advancing women's representation in political leadership. Sholakwe gave me an interesting way to think about the pushback women like Sewuse experienced when running for elective positions.
You know, coming out, there's a lot of violence against women. And then we even find out that physical violence might not even be physical violence is an issue, but there's also psychological violence. There's multiple forms of violence. There's social media bullying. There's harassment. There's articles in the newspapers, on the news, painting women, you know, that come out to run for political office, calling them all sorts of...
Let me jump in here for a moment. Sholakwe is essentially saying that gendered or gender-based violence poses a significant barrier for women seeking to enter politics at all levels. Now, before my conversation with her, I hadn't defined the constant harassment and scrutiny women face in politics regarding their gender as gender-based violence. But when you consider how women running for office are consistently subjected to humiliating questions and demeaning remarks, both online and offline, it becomes clearer that, by definition, this experience qualifies as gender-based violence. Gendered violence isn't limited to physical harm. It can manifest in other ways, like verbal violence, including hate speech against women in politics, or psychological violence, such as disinformation campaigns or threats aimed at undermining a woman's campaign. So if we bring it back to Sewuse's story, it becomes clear that she experienced gender-based violence when she declared her intention to run for office.
What do you think are the most common misconceptions about women, whether it's running for office, trying to, whatever form, like, and how do you think we can address these misconceptions?
Okay. So in terms of misconceptions, I would say that the biggest misconception is that women cannot be leaders, or women cannot be representatives, or women don't have what it takes, you know, to lead because of, you know, their biological makeup, or the fact that there's a lesser, you know, gender and whatever. That's such a huge and silly misconception. I would say that the second thing is that the capability of a woman. So it's like, even if you put her there, she's going to steal money, or she's not going to be able to know what to do and all of that. Like, why are you questioning the capability? Put her first. The men that have been sitting there, what have they been doing? Put her first, and then... if exactly. She doesn't succeed, then we'll go back to the drawing board. But at least put her there first.
I understand this. Women often face intense scrutiny and judgment regarding their leadership abilities compared to their male counterparts. That's why any woman, like Sewuse, who decides to run for office will likely be held to a much higher and more unrealistic standard than her male peers. So, as a woman, from the beginning, the odds are already stacked against you as a result of your gender. But there's more, and Sewuse helps break it down.
Politics is a business that needs huge capital, and elections are very expensive. And the worst part of it is elections have been monetized during campaign. They were very expensive. I needed numerous cars. I needed to feed the people that we were going together. I needed to take care of security. I needed to take care of emergency of health. I needed to take care of these cars. I rented the cars, so I have to fuel these cars.
Politics is expensive in any country. Earlier, I mentioned the high cost of nomination forms in Nigeria. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. As Sewuse mentioned, campaigning comes with a mountain of expenses. Here's Sholakwe again, pretty much confirming the same thing.
In reality, you have to print, you have to advertise, you have to speak to constituents, you have to do a lot of things, and these things cost money. And the reality is that the average woman doesn't make as much as the man. Like when you look at the economics of things, women are not as economically empowered as men in Nigeria society today. And so being able to mobilize resources, being able to get money, being able to have access to the same level of economic opportunities that men have is also something that is very, very important for women to be better in political leadership.
And in Sewuse's case, she received some support from family, friends, and a few well-wishers. But she acknowledges that her campaign would have reached a much wider audience if she had access to more financial resources. So Sewuse had to contend with misogyny, cultural beliefs, and a lack of resources throughout her campaign. Why is the experience in politics vastly different for Nigerian women? To answer that question, I decided to try something new. I called my sister, Fauzia Salahuddin. When I mentioned I was working on this limited series, she became interested in understanding the backstory of why women like Sewuse face discrimination when running for office in Nigeria. She prepared and sent me a list of questions about women's history in politics and governance to ask me, you know, given my research on the subject for this episode. I thought it would be incredibly insightful to record our conversation and feature it in this episode. It seemed like a great way to help more people understand the landscape for women in politics before Nigeria's independence.
Hi, Aisha.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm alive. I can't complain.
That's good. That's good. I really just thought I could sit with you a little bit and try to see if we can get some conversation going about voting and voter rights, like pre-democracy and post-democracy in Nigeria.
Yeah, that's why we're here. So I guess we can dig in, right? If you're good.
Okay. Awesome.
Fauzia and I don't usually talk like this. Our interactions are typically more chatty and natural. So having the conversation recorded felt weird. I'm used to being the one asking questions, so the role reversal was a bit unusual for me. And she was somewhat self-conscious, understandably. But we decided to kick things off anyway.
So before Nigeria gained independence from the British, what was it like for women?
The truth is, before Nigeria gained independence, it was nobody thought about women. There was nothing set in stone for women. And to be fair, before Nigeria gained independence, there was very little set in stone for Nigerian men as well. They were slightly considered, but for the women, it was like we weren't even in.
It's humbling to hear myself trying to answer questions that I'll normally pose to others during interviews. Nigeria was colonized by Britain, right? So before we gained independence from the British in 1960, our constitutions were named after whoever was Nigeria's governor at the time. For example, when Hugh Clifford was governor in 1922, we had the Clifford Constitution. And in 1946, when Arthur Richards was governor, we had the Richards Constitution.
So any of these did any of these past constitutions from these governor generals have anything at all in there about women? Did it favor women in politics?
At all. So it's like I said before, for example, let me look at the one for the Clifford Constitution real quick now. Give me a sec. I took some notes because I can't remember everything. Okay, so for example, like in 1923 now, Clifford Constitution gave voting powers to adult males who earned a minimum of £100, who were above 21, and who were British subjects or natives of Nigeria who had been residents in Calabar or Lagos for at least a year. So you can see how it's like, doesn't say anything about women. Same thing under the Richards Constitution in 1946, no provision was made for women. And like all the other constitutions that followed. So just to simply answer your question, there was no consideration for women really at all.
Yikes. So in that pre-independence era, when did things start looking up for us?
Okay, well, I think, So it wasn't like nothing was happening for women. It was just very, very slow progress. So like activists continued to lobby for women to be included in the electoral process. I think the year that things became slightly better was in 1948, in May 1948. There was a bill that was brought to light, and the bill essentially was like saying that every male and female over the age of 21 before 24th of January 1950, so if you turn 21 before that date, you'd be allowed to vote or be voted for, and this was for people in Lagos. So that's kind of progress in the sense that at least like they thought about women. The bad news is that in 1950, when like that bill came to review in Ibadan, people were, like, and when I think the MacPherson Constitution was being adopted, and people like voted against that bill, it was rejected. And it makes sense why it was rejected, because 53 men voted, and out of the 53, 42 said no. So like men didn't really understand the need, like why should we have women? So when you think about it in terms of progress, you see that it was progress because they even talked about women, but no progress because like it was shut down. So that's kind of like, I think, the moment where we started to see small changes.
Okay. So at what point in Nigerian history were we actually completely able to vote and be voted for?
Yeah, so it happened in tranches. It didn't happen like, it's not like there was a point, you get. It was like slow and steady. So for context, women in the West were able to vote and be voted for in 1959. Then women in the North, it didn't happen until 1979, like after independence. And I think women in the East, hold on, let me just get the numbers for women in the East. I mean, let me get the year rather that women were allowed to vote. So women in the East, it was 1954, I beg your pardon. So it wasn't that there was a moment that everything fell in place. It was like slow and steady, like for decades, like we started to see small improvements. So yeah, that's the gist.
Let me jump in here real quick. Even after women gained the right to vote and be voted for, it took many years before they were actively considered for roles in governance and politics. For context, after Nigeria gained independence in 1960, the military regimes that governed between 1960 and 1979 had cabinets composed solely of senior army officials, all of whom were men. The first inclusion of women in the cabinet occurred in the Second Republic under President Shehu Shagari, who served from 1979 to 1983, and there were just two women appointed at the time.
So even after we gained the rights or the ability to vote and be voted for, many men had already been able to get into politics in Nigeria as we gained independence. So why weren't women able to?
The simple truth is like, because from the beginning, like I said, even pre-independence, women were an afterthought. And so women had been included in the process little by little for decades. From, I think, as early as 1923, women were included in the process. So when you think about the fact that men were included in the process rather as early as 1923. But when you think about the fact that women didn't get included in the process until, like, let's say 1954, that is decades. Men had a head start and women are playing catch up.
Hold on, this packs a punch. For the longest time, most political parties did not have women's representation or consideration, primarily because there was no perceived need to include them, given that women couldn't vote. Historically, men have taken a dismissive stance towards women in politics and governance. Some of the leading politicians in Nigeria today began their careers during an era when women were heavily marginalized. So, men have pretty much had a head start in politics for centuries, and women are still playing catch up, even now in 2024. The prolonged disenfranchisement of women means there's hardly any institutional support for them when they run for office. It's why women like Sewuse will struggle with misogyny simply for seeking to exercise their political rights. My sister and I talked for about 12 minutes, and it wasn't all doom and gloom reflecting on the history of women in politics and governance. I mean, there have been trickles of progress here and there. For example, when Nigeria successfully transitioned from military rule in 1999, we began to see more women appointed into the cabinet.
The president of Nigeria, who is like applauded for having the most women in his cabinet, is Goodluck Jonathan. When you think about it, it's not a lot. It's 17 women. In the grand scheme of things, like, it's not that great, but he has that record right now.
By now, I think you've grasped what the landscape for women in politics and governance pre-independence looks like. But true to my journalistic nature, I couldn't end the call without tossing a question back at Fauzia.
I have a question for you. Based on everything that you have learned, how do you feel about when you think about Nigerian women in politics and governance? Do you feel optimistic just based on what you've learned? Or do you feel, well, do you feel like there's no hope?
I definitely don't feel like there's no hope. 100%. I'm increasingly optimistic of it, but it's also a bit of a careful optimism. Women, I'm sure, have a lot of hindrances when entering into politics and voting and voters' rights. Mainly, I think, because of the head start that men had over them, and maybe some cultural influences in there as well. But I'm really optimistic about the future of voting and women being a participatory candidates in our political system. I really think there's so much to hope for and so much to look forward to. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, fingers crossed. At least we're doing way better than many years ago. So let's see how that goes.
It can only go up from here.
Amen.
I appreciate that our conversation ended on a note of optimism. Despite the grim history lesson, one can only hope for the best, right? Yet, it was enlightening to recall that the inclusion of women in the electoral process was once completely overlooked. It became such an entrenched norm that when the idea of universal voting rights was proposed, the men in power couldn't understand why women would be valuable as voters or candidates. And today, we still observe the remnants of that disenfranchisement and mindset in politics and governance. Now, here's Sholakpe with a quick breakdown of what the current political landscape looks like for women.
Okay, so I think that we all know that the state of women's representation in Nigeria is abysmal, right? It's really bad. And I don't think that people know the extent to how bad it is. I think that a lot of people weigh it with the National Assembly, which is the easiest thing to do because we have the numbers, you know, in the broad view that in the Senate, there's 4 women out of 109 senators. And in the House of Representatives, there is 17 women out of 360 House of Representative members. So when you throw the numbers out there, like, oh, there's just 17 women, people need to put it into context that there's 360 seats in total. And that means that 300 and something are men and the remaining 17 are women. So when you look at the National Assembly, it's easy to put it into context that only about 4% of our legislative house that creates bills, that does oversights, that puts the executive in check, that forms most of our policy direction, that passes bills, only like 4% of those people are women. Now, when you actually look at the executive side of things, broadly speaking, in the executive, there's a few deputy governors, but there's no female governor, there's no female president, there's no female vice president. And then in cabinets, you know, around the country, there's representation of like some women, but there's no cabinet that has 50%, even 40% representation.
Yeah, when we look at the representation of women within the executive and legislative arms of the Nigerian government today, like Sholakwe analyzed, the numbers aren't impressive. While some states like Kwara are performing better than others, the numbers are still quite concerning in the broader context. Which brings me back to Sewuse's political journey. She didn't emerge as the winner in the 2019 Boko East State House of Assembly elections. However, considering the financial constraints she faced and the challenges she encountered as a woman throughout her campaign, she performed really well.
Something that is remarkable and prideful for a politician, I won my polling unit first. Then I won several polling units too.
According to the Independent National Electoral Commission, INEC, Sehu State gathered 2,294 votes, securing the third position after candidates from Nigeria's two major parties, APC and PDP. Nevertheless, she outperformed 13 other candidates by a significant margin. Not bad for someone who contested with limited resources, right?
If you see at the general statistics and spread out, you see that I was loved, I was accepted. But because I lacked the funding and because I was a woman and from a smaller party, then I lost out.
Sehu State struggled emotionally and financially after her election loss. This experience highlighted for her the importance of self-preservation for women who run for office and don't win.
So post-elections, aftercare elections is very, very important. And it is much, much recommended for people that did not win the polls. Because the winner is already basking in euphoria, in joy, and the entire crowd are following because that is where the light is now. So the ones who have lost are abandoned with their hurt, with their disappointment, with their shattered dreams, with their heartbreaks. Some persons become sick, some even die after this post-election loss. Yes.
I'm embarrassed to admit that before my conversation with Sehu State, I'd never considered the impact of post-election loss, especially on women in politics, given that women, compared to their male counterparts, endure much greater scrutiny when running for office. I can fully understand why losing an election would be particularly painful. Sehu State found solace in her family and some friends. Thankfully, for young people and women in politics, there are organizations and CSOs that offer post-election training and workshop to reflect on campaign periods. One of such organizations for Sehu State was Yaga Africa, a CSO dedicated to promoting participation in democracy and human rights. Personally, I believe that the fiscal, mental, and financial toll of running for office is often underestimated. It requires tremendous effort, mobilization, rallying supporters, financial investments, and covering continuous communication and advertising expenses. It's an exhaustive process that can be daunting even for the most resilient individuals. So I'm thankful that Sehu State had a supportive network to rely on throughout this journey. Let's fast forward real quick to 2023. In 2023, Sehu State, now 33, decided once again to run for office. This time, she targeted a much bigger seat at the Federal House of Representatives. She contested under the banner of the African Democratic Congress, ADC, as a candidate for the Gboko-Taka Federal Constituency.
I discovered that the support I enjoyed in 2019 pulled back. Again, because I was a female. Then this time around, I saw even few family, extended family members and my friends, my cycle, not supporting me. The fact I beat more than I could chew.
There you have it. Despite her experience in the 2019 elections, Sehu State found the 2023 House of Representatives campaign to be even more challenging. The same issues resurfaced, but this time they were compounded by increased scrutiny and opposition. More individuals, including some family members and people she considered friends, criticized her audacity to vie for a higher office. That's indeed a really tough spot to be in.
So in 2023, I saw people that did not believe in my dream, people that felt I was aspiring too big, and then they were not going to be part of that big dream. I should go ahead and do what I, or rather go ahead and use what I saw to think and feel that I can do this. So I was swimming in an ocean and against the current with no help at all. But I kept doing it because it gave me a sense of purpose and fulfillment, but it was a very nasty experience.
In the midst of the pain, Sewuse persevered through a grueling 6 months of campaigning with very little support. Through it all, she held on to the belief that her quest for political office was not just a duty to the people of Boko in Benue State, but a sacred duty to God. On February 25th, 2023, the highly anticipated election took place, with Sewuse going head-to-head against 17 other candidates. Once again, despite her efforts, she did not emerge victorious. But like the resilient individual she is, Sewuse handled the defeat with grace and composure. At least that's what she openly expresses. When I asked Sewuse if she plans to run for office again in the next election cycle, she didn't hesitate to respond with a confident yes. Her continuous determination, despite the challenges she has faced, is nothing short of inspiring. It takes immense courage and determination to navigate through such pain and discrimination and still choose to stand up and fight again. I must admit, I'm really rooting for her. And while I admire Sewuse's resilience, I think it's important to consider how we can ease the path into politics for more women like her, to prevent more women from experiencing the pain that comes with prejudice against them in politics. This important conversation about how we can pave the way for women entering politics will unfold in episode 3 of this limited series. There, we'll dig deeper into identifying and advocating for effective support mechanisms for women like Sewuse stepping into the political arena. But for the next episode.
And then the first attack was a verbal assault. The man calling me a prostitute. He said, "There comes the prostitute. Look at Natasha Ashewo. Natasha Ashewo, get out. You are not wanted here."
We will explore the story of Natasha Hadiza Akpoti-Uduaghan, the first woman to occupy a Senate seat in Kogi State, North Central Nigeria. We also explore what the Constitution says about women's rights to vote and be voted for, and why it is important to champion and protect women's rights to run for office in Nigeria. Thank you for listening to this episode of I Like Girls. If you'd like to get in touch with us, follow us on Instagram and Twitter at I Like Girls Gang. This episode was written and produced by me, Aisha Salahuddin. Research was conducted by Jolomi Otomewo. Audio engineering and sound design were handled by Mo Isu, and our editor is Peter Akinusi. Our theme music is by Bangs with a double G. Special thanks to the Election Network and Document Women for partnering with us on this episode, and to Fauzia Salahuddin, Sholakwe Shonuga, and Sewuse Ibem for their invaluable contributions to this episode. The news reports at the start of this episode were obtained from Channels TV and Africa News. I'll catch you on the next episode.